Shares. Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that loves earnings season just a little bit too much, but not so much that we're going to be boring. Trust us, stick with us. I'm Scott Phillips, and as always, with me is Dr. Anirban Mahanty. G'day, Doc.
Good day, Captain. How are you?
Mate, I'm exceptionally well because it's earnings palooza, mate. It's all about earnings season. We're exactly halfway through the month as we record this on Thursday. Happy Valentine's Day to our listeners.
That's true.
You'll hear this a little bit late, guys, because it'll probably go up tomorrow, I assume, unless our producer Will decides to pull a Swiftie on us and put it up early. In any case, we're recording this Thursday morning. I'll be on the Gold Coast tomorrow. Not sunning myself. I'm actually working. But in any case, good to be with you. Happy Valentine's Day, mate.
Have
you got something organised for your wife?
No.
Dear, you're in trouble.
I'm in trouble. I actually just realised it's Valentine's Day when you said
dear, oh dear. You've at least got the rest of the day to sort something out. Pretend you're always going to do it. Some roses sent to your wife right now is probably a good thing.
I think maybe booking dinner.
I'm helping you out too. We're all about the love here at Motley Fool Money.
Yeah, we are. Definitely.
For it. Speaking of love, it's time to talk about Telstra. How excited are you, Doc?
I am supremely excited at Telstra's awesomely...
All right. So we're going to talk about Telstra. We're going to talk about a few other companies and earnings palooza. Been a busy week already this week for company earnings. Talk about Telstra, car sales, CSL, AMP Super Retail. Give a sense of the state of the economy, the state of some of our largest and bluest of blue chip companies. We're also going to talk about the fact that CEO killing season, we thought it was over. It's not.
It looks like it's not.
Another CEO shown the door this week, or showing himself the door, depending on which version of the truth you like to believe. And we'll talk about a new credit card that most of us can't have.
Nobody told me about it.
Exactly. And we'll dip into the full mailbag. All right, Doc, let's get this show underway. It is time to talk about Telstra, and no, not Tesla, Telstra, the better one with extra letters for free. One of the most profitable companies on the ASX. I know how excited you are by large profits. And so Telstra came out this morning with its earnings. Unfortunately, the first sentence of Jenny Duke's story in the SMH says, Telstra CEO Andy Pence, the telecommunications company, continues to face short-term challenges ahead of an ultra-fast 5G mobile network launch while reporting a profit fall in the first half of 2019. Dear, oh dear. Telstra, go on. I know you've got wonderful, lovely things to say, but I know how much you love the company. So tell us some nice things about Telstra.
Yeah, I love the company. I mean, you know, the headline I read was different. You know, it basically said 28% drop in first half profits.
details.
It's all about
the future. It's all about 5G, haven't I told you?
It's all about the future, yeah. So, I don't know, Telstra's results.
What do you make of them? Anything in particular?
I thought they were meh. In my opinion,
meh.
In my opinion, is I think as good as it gets.
You won't see that in a report from Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs.
No, it's only at the Fool.
delightfully informal as we are.
In full fooldom, we'll say that it was a meh result.
So you're not particularly happy about it. The shares are down 2% as we record this on about 20 to 11 on Thursday morning. So the market kind of responding about the same as you.
Yeah, I had a quick look through actually their very long report. At least I'll give them credit. You know, unlike many other companies, they actually do a good job of producing a good report, which you can actually read through. So
heaps of information.
Heaps of
really,
information.
Really big
So, you know, credit where it is due.
Yep.
I think it's really well done, the report. So anybody who's invested there, I think they should, you know, have a look at the report. But, you know, at a high level, the main issue here was, you know, that they're still suffering from the transition that's happening to NBN. But, you know, I just don't think that mobile is that big a growth area for them. It's
okay.
2%, you know, was the, what's 2%?
Oh, for now, sure. But what about 5G? Does 5G get them across the line?
I don't think so. So I don't think any telco is going to actually make zillions of dollars from 5G.
I think I can agree with you there. Yeah. Zillions are probably out of the question.
Zillions is out of the question. Even billions, I don't know. They're going to invest a lot on equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Then they will all compete against each other to give cheap plans. I really hope there's competition because that's good for the consumer.
Right.
The consumer is going to get really awesome internet when 5G is around. And I think the real winners are going to be, you know, those people who actually have apps and stuff and services that are running on those internets, right? So, I mean, these guys are basically a utility company. And expecting that 5G is somehow going to change it from being a utility company to a tech company, which Telstra has tried a number of times to be. You know, it's part of their T22, whatever they want to call it. Right? So it's always T22. Like, it's always, in 5 years, we'll be something great. So I am willing to put my money and say that in 5 years, Telstra will remain Telstra. And nothing is going to change. And it's going to be a telco. And it's going to be a utility. And it's going to, you know, generate a good amount of cash flow. And it'll be able to pay dividends. But, you know, anybody expecting serious growth here, you know, they're likely not going to get it. That's my take.
We're going to keep these short because we have got a bit to get through. I'm going to just give you a quick rejoinder, which is, I don't think the company probably wants us to think it's going to be a tech company. I don't think the investment case relies on us accepting that directly. I think the shares are cheap enough right now. I actually expect 5G will gain them some market share in mobile. And I think, although I could be wrong, unless they change something fundamental about the NBN, I actually expect Telstra to win back customers, higher margin customers back from the NBN, back to the 5G network. The sale of 5G wireless kind of modems, the kind of Wi-Fi devices you can have in your home or take with you, all of a sudden it's going to not be particularly sensible to have NBN if you can take your mobile with you, if you can get better, faster speeds. I know at home my 4G connection is about 2.5 times the speed of my NBN connection, which is weird enough. And so at some level, I do expect that 5G uptake to be particularly impressive. And I think at that level, Telstra is worth more than it is worth today. I don't think it's going to be a high growth company. It's not going to be a tech company, as you say, with tech multiples and tech growth. But I think Telstra is going to be worth more in the future than it is today. And I think 5G will probably lead that charge as it stops losing business from landline and gets mobile growth through number of services. And frankly, the price, the average price people are paying as they transition from a cheaper mobile plan to a all-you-can-eat or close enough to that 5G wireless plan. I think it's going to lead Telstra's growth into the future.
It's pretty bullish. It almost calls for a bet.
I couldn't take more of your money, mate. We'll hold that over. We'll talk about terms. We'll talk about terms during the week, okay. And we'll come back next week with a bet, just to keep the show moving.
All right,
Motley Fool Money,
mate. Speaking of moving, how's this for a segue? So moving, ooh, driving cars, car sales.
Car sales.
I'm a natural. Mate, car sales were out this week, and results were a bit disappointing. The market wasn't very happy. It's all about display advertising. The insurers, the finance companies, the car dealers aren't paying for the old banner display ads as much as they were. People still listing their cars for sale, but a very large chunk of sales come from that display ads, and they're down because, frankly, people aren't selling as many new cars as they were.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's symptomatic of the economy or something. But yeah, so people are not, you know, people who are buying $30,000 cars are now maybe buying $25,000 cars. People
or not
who are,
buying cars at all.
Or maybe not
problem,
buying
right?
cars. Or maybe they're, instead of buying a new car, they're buying a used car. And if they were buying a used car, they're keeping the used car longer.
Right. I think that's the driver. Yeah.
That's the driver. So I think you can tell when you look at the earnings release and the first thing they talk about is international growth.
Look over there, over there.
Look over there. Look in South Korea and Brazil. We are doing well.
Which is impressive, by the way.
Which is good. And, you know, I'm saying that in a half like a joke. But I mean, it is great that, you know, they're going elsewhere and have acquired different things and are trying to do, you know, they have tried to address the situation, but yeah, the dependence still in the core business is here, and they're feeling the pain. Yep. Plus, the pain around the leasing and financing and is also showing. So some weakness there. I mean, what I didn't like about it was the revenue growth was actually pretty good, but the operating profit growth was not that good. So you know, they're not getting really leverage out of it.
I agree. I think. The company is very leveraged. I think this is what most people get wrong about both Domain, REA, and car sales. That's not both. That's all three. Which is the number of listings won't necessarily change when it comes to the volume of stuff going around. But the premium products that people are paying for, whether it's display advertising on car sales, whether it's those so-called bump listings, the premium listings on Domain and REA, that's what will come down if people start to figure the market might be weaker than they perhaps had previously thought.
Yeah.
And so that's the bit I want people to be a little bit careful. Now, I think car sales are still a buy, by the way, and I think, for the record, REA is a hold. Just to put that on the table, there are recommendations at Motley Fool Share Advisor. So being very clear about that, I don't own either stock. But I think in that case, you've got to be a little bit careful. I still believe in the long-term story. But in the short term, just think cautiously about people saying, oh, people will still sell houses, people will still sell cars. Yes, they will. But how much will they pay to sell those cars and those houses? That's what's going to crimp margins if it happens.
If I may quickly add one more thing. I think the phenomenon of ads moving to things like Gumtree and you know, Facebook's marketplace, that's very real. That's I think maybe gathered steam. Again, I don't have any data to prove that, but you know, this is all anecdotal, just looking at stuff. There's a lot of car ads now on Gumtree. It's like unbelievable. Yeah, right. And you can bump up stuff and you can do all, you know, pay premium, high listings and things like that. So
I'm bearish on that as an idea, but I take your point. It's definitely a risk for car sales and REA.
Yeah. Motley Fool Money.
Mate, this is one of my favorite headings of the week. Mm-hmm. Market draws blood as CSL fails to beat high expectations. Again, that's from the SMH. So the company had a $1.7 billion profit for the first half, lifted its full-year earnings guidance, and still the shares fell. And this is the price you pay for high expectations. I want to say the price you pay, frankly, the price shareholders pay, because the company doesn't win or lose, right? It's just a collection of shareholders. The market is so used to expecting wonderful things from CSL that when they're just simply very good, the market ends up disappointed. The shares fell meaningfully when the earnings were released. What do you make of CSL? I mean, 11% growth in revenue, right? This is, for a very, very big company, this is very impressive. I have to say, for what it's worth, we've avoided recommending it at ShareAdvisor recently because of those high expectations. To grow at the historical rates from bigger and bigger bases is just incredibly tough, right? At some point, you max out the available market. What did you make of CSL's results?
So I think you've covered most of the bases here. I mean, I think the market probably was expecting that they would do an upgrade to the profit guidance, which was not there. I mean, they said they'll hit whatever the $1.9 billion that they said they're going to hit, which is a pretty big number. I don't know. Like, I mean, I think the franchise they've got on, you know, the blood products is pretty solid product, you know, solid franchise. And then, you know, they've got the stuff going on with these influenza vaccines and so on, and that's really doing well.
Yep.
So 10% growth in revenue, you know, it's not a lot.
No. Well, it depends, right? It's pretty good for most companies. It's not tech growth size, but most companies are happy with 10%.
But I would say that, you know, for a biotech, like a, you know, this size biotech, it's modest. I wouldn't say this is huge, but again, if it's stable, I think the stability of that growth is what matters, and I think that's what you get with this, you know, blood product group. The price to earnings ratio has come down.
Yeah, still on 32 times earnings, I last I checked.
It's 32 times earnings. I mean, a couple of things here. You're getting international earnings, a lot of international earnings. Yep. You're getting diversification. Mm-hmm. You're getting a puny dividend, I guess. Mm-hmm. Less than 2%, I would say.
Yep.
It's not quite in the buy range for me yet. Mm. You know, if it had 15% revenue growth and it was at, you know, 30 times earnings, I would think because maybe some leverage would give them, you know, higher earnings growth, maybe in the mid-teens to, you know, 20% range or so, something like that. Mm. But yeah.
I still can't work out whether, if you think about the compound growth, we love compound growth, but when you get to a certain size, can a blood products business become that much larger than it is today in compound terms over 5 or 10 years? I just don't know how it does it. I don't, margins are already pretty high. Growth is decent. I mean, 10% growth when you're that big is actually pretty impressive to actually generate that much more revenue year on year. You've got to find more people to treat, more products to sell, whatever. At some level, you kind of just run out of runway, don't you?
Yeah, well, you do and you don't, in the sense that there's also, you have to value the pipeline of the products that have got in the making, right? So what they're getting is from their existing product line, right? And if they can actually get another blockbuster product up and running. So you have to see how effective their R&D is, really. Mm-hmm. And that really matters for biotech companies.
Motley Fool Money.
From the sublime to the something else, I'm going to give you two numbers.
Mm-hmm.
$4 billion of fund outflows. In other words, people taking $4 billion away from a fund manager.
Boom. Yeah.
And profit falling 97%,
mm-hmm.
which kind of leaves about 3% left from last time. If I gave you those two numbers, what company would you think of?
AMP.
I mean, we laugh, and there may be some people listening who are long-suffering AMP shareholders. If that's true of you, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
But seriously, mate, this is just a business that is hemorrhaging in a big, big way, right? So $4 billion lost during the quarter, higher than the $1.5 billion it lost in the previous quarter.
Yeah.
The company is saying it expects a similar level of outflows in the first quarter of this year.
Yeah.
Add that all together, that's close enough to $10 billion of money lost. Now, when they clip the ticket on a proportion of all that money in or out of the fund, if I can say anything positive, it's that the Royal Commission didn't make AMP split itself up, which frankly I would have done, as I said last week. But what can we say about AMP's result and frankly its kind of future outlook?
Yeah, I mean, the Royal Commission didn't have to do anything. It's all happening automatically anyways.
Right.
The future doesn't look nice. Mm. I mean, there's lots of dark clouds and really dark clouds here. The outflows, I mean, what's interesting is that, you know, among the traditional managers, AMP is one of the hardest hit in terms of outflows of funds, right? Yep. And they're clipping the tickets on it. On the other hand, people like, you know, Macquarie Group, for example, are still leading in terms of fund inflows.
Yeah.
So there's really a two two classes here. But I think, you know, all these scandals and the, you know, performance in the Royal Commission and so on, I think has, you know, probably is going to accelerate fund outflow from them to other platforms, be it, you know, the likes of Macquarie or other independent platforms.
You've got to think so, right? Like, yeah, if you're a financial planner, how do you with a straight face say to your client, I think you should put money in AMP?
Yeah, it's very, very difficult.
The only people they've got left are the AMP's own in-house planners who are A, very conflicted, and B, if the Royal Commission's recommendation is taken, they're going to have to say to their customers, so I'm not independent and I'm not unbiased, but still I think you should take my advice. It's a tough road.
So I think that it's a really, really difficult spot. I mean, if, you know, one solution for them might be to actually sell or spin off their wealth management business, then I don't know what is left then, right?
Well, that's
the thing. The life insurance is gone.
It's so dramatically ingrained that its entire business model relies on it being an integrated financial services company. If you split it up, I don't know how either survives. Yeah. This was a $16 share price back in 2008.
It's what, like
11 years later? $2.30.
Oh, that got hurt.
And it's just been, you know, again, the worst thing is about a year ago when it was almost $6, people said, oh, it's already lost, you know,
so much.
Almost two-thirds. How much further can it fall? The answer is another 65-70%. Mm. So just been a very ugly story. Look, maybe there's some value there for value hunters, just because at some point, if something's bombed out enough, it doesn't have to do much right, maybe, to get some sort of revised, you know, evaluation from the market. So if you're kind of desperately deep value, I can see why people might go
cigar
there.
Butt type of thing?
Almost.
But you can get burnt, you know. If the fire is still there, you're likely to get burnt.
Amen.
Motley Fool Money.
Let's go to the fifth of our five we're going to cover this week, mate, with Super Retail. Now, Super Retail, I've been looking at both this and JB Hi-Fi in particular in the last couple of weeks, just as some sort of view on what's happening in the economy. You mentioned car sales before and the fact that maybe it talks about what's happening in the economy. To some degree, I don't own shares of either JB or Super Retail. The Motley Fool does own shares of Super Retail. But broadly speaking, I was kind of interested to see these companies because they're to some degree, I wouldn't say necessarily bellwethers, although JB Hi-Fi might be, but just some sense of actually how is the physical economy really going? What's actually happening out there? To some degree, how much people are spending or not spending. I have to say this morning's results were pretty decent. When you look at a retailer, the first thing I always do is go straight to the like-for-like or same-store sales, depending on what the company likes to call them. The idea is basically you can open more stores and get growth. That's easy. Anyone can do that. If you've got five stores and you open 10, you double your sales. You look like a genius. All you're really doing is opening more stores. What you really want to know is, are the stores you already have getting more people to spend more money year after year? And so far for Super Retail, with the exception of their Raise Outdoors business, they've had decently positive like-for-like sales, somewhere between 1.4 and about 2.1, I think it was, per brand. So these guys own Supercheap Auto, they own Rebel, they own MacPack, which is the old Raise Outdoors.
Amart?
Super Amart,
yeah.
So, you know, these are not exactly covering the waterfront. They're kind of specialized to some degree. But between that and JB Hi-Fi, I've got to say, man, I'm an optimist anyway. And as you rightly say, car sales on the other side of the ledger. But I was quietly happy to see that the consumer is still spending. These guys are still getting people to spend more. While there are signs of maybe a consumer slowdown, I thought the results were pretty credible. And for Super Retail, I think, again, in every one of their banners, though I could be wrong, I'd have to check, but in almost all of them, if not all of them, their same-store sales actually increased in the last 8 weeks or 6 weeks relative to the last half. In other words, the same store sales growth is accelerating, which, again, it's hard to look at that and not think, well, maybe there are some hot signs of hope, some reasons for optimism when it comes to the Australian economy.
Maybe I don't follow Super Retail closely, but maybe, you know, I'll call it a two-stage problem. We're in stage one where people are not spending big bucks.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're not spending, they're not buying a new house, they're not investing in property, they're not buying a new car.
Mm.
Right. I mean, you know, you go to JB Hi-Fi and you buy like an HDMI cable, how much does it really cost? And it gives you a television to watch.
They're still getting growth on last year, though. I think that's fair. But if they're buying one last year, they're buying two this year. There's something positive about
that. So that's positive. But I think, you know, it's smaller, you know, smaller average purchase size and all of those sort of things.
True.
So, and, you know, Rebel, I mean, you know, you'd go to Rebel and buy whatever is, you know, Under Armour shirts on discount or whatever it is, right? So if you have, you know, or a Nike shirt on discount or whatever it is, I mean, so, you know, there's a lot of discounting that goes on those stores. But yeah, I mean, the consumer is still spending. It's not the consumer has the
pocket. You are finding despair in the face of optimism, Doc. I'm just giving you positive numbers and you're telling me reasons why it can't possibly be true. Come on.
Well, you know, you can use Zip Pay, Afterpay, and every other type of pay to buy stuff, right?
Yes.
So, but you know, it's helping actually these small spends by bringing it in forward.
So we're all positive, we're optimistic, we're hopeful.
Maybe.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Now, mate, last week we talked about CEO killing season, and I don't know if I thought it was necessarily over, but I wasn't thinking about, I wonder what will happen next week. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on which way you look at it, we're talking about it again because another CEO walked that very familiar, very well-worn plank straight off the edge into the abyss while the company hopes to right itself. The market wasn't very happy. The company, of course, is Experience Co. Used to be called Skydive the Beach. Does a lot of those skydiving activities, the businesses around the country. Lost its CEO, I think, one other executive too, in the last week. Shares fell, I want to say, by about a third on the news, and it came with an earnings downgrade. That's kind of that's a triple threat, right, in all the worst possible ways. So, and again, that's on the back of the NAB CEO going, a whole lot of other CEOs. Who else went last week? There was a mountain of them.
Yeah, Catapult.
That's right, Catapult CEO went. What happened to Experience Co, mate? What's going on? And was the CEO pushed? Did he jump? Was it worthwhile? What's actually happening?
So is this basically a Telstra, you know, punchback from your side?
No,
you know?
No.
Experience Co is a company on the Extreme Opportunities scorecard,
right?
And so was Catapult, and you know, we've had two CEOs. You know, maybe this is the thing. Oh, if you're on an Extreme Opportunities scorecard, your CEO goes.
start polishing your CV.
Start polishing your CV. The news was not good, but I mean, maybe the news was in the making for a while because you know they've had a couple of downgrades. They had a weather-related downgrade not too long ago. They had reforecast the guidance, and then now they're again basically reforecasting the guidance. Right.
So sounds ugly.
Sounds ugly, and it is one of those things. You know, if your business is dependent to some extent on whether people can skydive or not, because and that depends on the weather, maybe you shouldn't really try to forecast, because you know even the people at the you know the Bureau of Meteorology, even they can't forecast what's going to happen in a year. So you really need to have you know more skills than bomb.
don't get me started on bloody management forecasting. It's the absolute biggest waste of time in corporate Australia.
But maybe if you run Woolies, it's okay.
then they still don't get it right.
Yeah, but I mean you know. You can get it in the ballpark. But, you know,
where's the benefit?
Here, the weatherman would refuse. So I think that's the problem.
Company CEOs exist to make weathermen look good, Doc.
Yeah. I mean, so it was unfortunate. I mean, yeah. So a downgrade. I mean, the company is still generating operating profit. Mm-hmm. It's still one of the largest. You know, there are some bright sides. Bright spots that still, they did well on the skydiving side. So what really is not working well for them is the stuff that they've acquired in Northern Queensland, which is all adventure tourism related.
Diversification, do you think, or teething problems?
Well, could be both, you know. Okay. Again, it's hard to tell. So we'll have to look at the, you know, half year results and be on the conference call to tell more. From what we could tell, that, you know, it could also be the case that, you know, you have companies which try to grow by acquisition, and growth by acquisition is really tricky. You really need to know what you're doing, and it's really hard.
Yeah.
So, It's on hold for us now.
So what's the verdict, though? CEO deserved to go, walked the plank, got pushed. Would you have got rid of him? What's going on there?
Well, I think it's fair. If you know, the CEO, well, it said the CEO resigned, so I'm not going to speculate. I mean, probably he was let go, or, you know, he decided to resign, whatever it is. Yep. I mean, you know.
But clearly it's related to the performance, right?
It looks like it's related to the performance. And I think if the board took the call that they decided to replace, and they also asked, it looks like the founder and executive director is also taking a step back, and it's basically the case where it appears like you founded a good business, you did some acquisitions, but maybe it's hard to actually manage a small business that you used to run versus a you want to run a an enterprise that's national and growing. It's a really hard thing to do. And
maybe so next level CEO required?
A professional CEO, hopefully. It's going to be a hard challenge to find someone for these sort of things, right? You'll have to see what happens.
And what odds do you give me that we're not talking about this next week? Is there another CEO in the gun, do you think? Are we going to have to come back and say killing season has been extended, or do we think this might be the end of it?
You know, with my luck, maybe we will. So I'm not going to put any money on it, but we'll see.
We will.
I'm hoping it's not going to happen, but we don't know.
If there is a positive for investors out there, chances are, confession season is what we normally call January, where people get out ahead of this sort of news. Experience Co. remarkably late, went into a trading halt, then released some numbers, which is kind of in the middle of earnings season. Obviously, just come to the conclusion that, they're going to have some bad numbers to report. for the most part, though, most of the bad news should be out, at least the kind of market disappointing bad news. Is that fair to say in terms of earnings updates or confessions we're going to have?
So for most of the bigger companies, I think that's true. For the smaller companies, they all try to report it the last day, right? And maybe they've just started. You know, this is the problem. If you're a really small company with a $100 million market cap, you are actually doing your accounting right now, using an accountant who's right across the street from you,
right.
And then trying to, you know, then you're trying to do your numbers. So I think that's the problem, right? I mean, many of these companies are really small and therefore, by definition, risky.
All right, buckle up. There might be more to come.
Yeah.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Now, mate, we're used to companies who try and sell us stuff. You can't walk down the street, turn on your computer, watch TV, you're getting text messages on your phone. Everyone's trying to sell you something. This week, though, we got news of Qantas releasing a new product that they're telling us we can't have. In fact, more than 97% of us don't get to have this particular product. Now, it's pretty unusual for a company to come out and say, you can't have this. What is it? It's the new Qantas Titanium credit card. There's enough precious metals left. They can call it. They've got gold and platinum and now titanium. I don't know what comes next. I don't know if it's a uranium or molybdenum or something.
Maybe something out of the galaxy.
Andromeda. You're the scientist here. Give me an element that's rare. And
no, you just go to the universe and you go to the next universe. It's like Andromeda card or something like that.
So that's going to come
Star
next.
Star Wars.
So Qantas this week have released their titanium card. And here's the good news for all of us. Well, bad news, good news. It depends what you look at it. We're not getting invited. You have to earn more than $200,000 a year for Qantas to accept you as an owner, possessor, maybe a borrower. For the Qantas Titanium credit card. And they're going to charge you $1,200 a year for the privilege. That is the annual fee for this card. That's phenomenal. Apparently, some of the benefits, they say it's going to be the highest earning card in terms of points per dollar spent. They're also going to give you 10% off two flights a year. 10% off for $1,200. And some departure lounge invitations. So, Doc, let's just say that I'm very generous and I managed to get you another pay rise of a meaningful sum. Are you going to take up the Qantas Titanium credit card?
So I'm going to start first by saying that, you know, I did not know of this until you mentioned this morning. So the couple of thoughts came to my mind. A, that, you know, you need to give me a pay rise. That's number one. Number two,
won't be happy.
I guess so. Number two, that Qantas knows that I don't make enough money.
I didn't get a letter either. Don't worry about that.
I did not know about this. I had not heard about this. And no email. And I'm a loyal Qantas card user. You know, I bank all the Qantas points and stuff. So
Qantas is your preferred airline?
It's my preferred airline. You know, all my points go to Qantas.
And they're still looking after you. This is the weird thing about this.
I'll say this. I'm actually happy that they didn't tell me. Because there's no way on earth I'm paying them $1,200 for a credit card. It doesn't matter what it comes with. There's no way they can get $1,200.
Not even for the departure lounge invitations? I'll have 10% off a couple of flights.
$1,200 is almost the cost of an iPhone.
I know.
And there's no way I'm buying.
iPhones are bloody expensive. I've mentioned that before. Anyway.
That's another thing.
I love frequent flyer points. I love flights and flying. I think, you know, in terms of, I love doing it, but from an economics perspective, from a behavioral finance perspective, you can kind of leave common sense at the door when it comes to airlines, right? The amount of money people, so you think about flying to, let's say LA, right? 13-hour flight, give or take.
Mm-hmm.
You can get there probably for, I don't know, $1,000 return, something like that on a good day. People will pay, instead of the $1,000, $3,000 or $5,000, $8,000, depending on what class you want to fly to LA. And if you put that back into an hourly rate, the extra money people will pay to lie flat for 12 hours, it's money you wouldn't spend on anything else. If you said to somebody else, here's a thing that costs $1,000, but for a slightly better experience, you pay an extra $7,000 on top of that, people would look at you like you were crazy. Mm. If I offered you the iPhone X for $1,500 and the iPhone X Plus One for $8,000, people are like, I'm not paying that. That's ridiculous. I'm not doing that. It might do a couple of extra things, but that's not worth it. But for some people, this prestige, this status idea of premium economy, business, first class, we just lose all of our sense and start throwing money at things. And it's kind of the same with these credit card status symbols, right? The Amex, what was the Amex? Was it the Platinum card? There's a Centurion card with Amex that's by invitation only. It's like the Qantas Chairman's Lounge, same kind of idea. These things are just, as soon as you put a credit card status symbol or a flight in front of people, all the usual common sense, behavioral finance, good things that we do go completely out the window and people go a little bit nuts.
That's true. I'm just still depressed that there's a card like that.
and well, that's the other thing, right? So I'll just
say one more thing. Yep. You know, a lot of people in the pointy of the plane, they are basically flying because the company has paid for it, right? So, I mean, yeah, you know, if somebody's paying for it, hey, I'll take it. That sounds good to me. Or if it's a free upgrade or something, I'll take it.
I think that's absolutely true in those senses. I agree. But even the thing, the company would pay that much. Like, again, you think about it, okay, let's say we're flying to LA, 13 hours. We don't fly business class, put it that way. We certainly don't fly first class. When a company's going to pay them, I just can't, on an ROI basis, the sheer dollar value of that. Put it the other way, if you said to someone, you can fly business class or you can have $5,000 in your back pocket from the company, how many people are you going to fly business versus pocketing the $5,000? So it's kind of just...
I think 90% are going to take the money.
Right. It's just as I said, when people go to flights or credit card status points, it just goes completely nuts. And I wrote this morning an article. I basically said, look, there's an old saying that back in the old days when Carrie Pecker was still alive, that you didn't want to be on the other side of a deal with KP because you knew he was getting a pretty good deal. Mm. It's kind of like that with credit card companies, right? It's like, Groucho Marx said, I wouldn't want to be a member of any club that would have me. I kind of feel like that with credit cards. If they're chasing you to spend $1,200 to buy this new Qantas Titanium credit card, guess what? They're getting the good end of the stick on this one. So yes, you can feel good. People will do it, by the way, because they want the prestige of handing the card over and the shop assistant or the person beside them in line going, wow, that's a Titanium card.
Well, hopefully out of this, it keeps Qantas out of bankruptcy or any such thing. So that's
well,
good.
So here's the thing.
It's good for Australia. We'll have an old airline that's not going to go bankrupt.
Speaking of that very quickly, Qantas make a quarter of their profit from their frequent flyer scheme. A quarter. $400 million a year from this exact kind of thing writ large, right?
So it's going to be now $500 million.
It's an just extraordinary amount of money. I mean, these guys are closer to being a frequent flyer scheme that happens to fly airplanes rather than an airline company with a frequent flyer scheme. This is one of the biggest profit generators for them overall. It's just, and if you think about that, it is also too, from an investing angle very quickly, something that we should look at when we look at companies, and anyone should look at, is where's the value being generated? If you'd said to somebody, hey, where does Qantas make its money? I reckon what, 1 in 20, 1 in 30, 1 in 40 people would say, "Oh, in the frequent flyer scheme." I mean, if you study Qantas closely, you know, right? But even for seasoned investors who aren't following the airline space at all, and we tend not to, if we ask around the office, how much money does Qantas make as a proportion from its frequent flyer scheme? I don't reckon too many people would say 25%. It is just a
10% maybe
margin.
At max.
Just phenomenal. So it's always worth as an investor think about areas of hidden value, or maybe just understanding better. And you think, well, Qantas makes money from flying planes. Well, kinda, but it makes a whole lot of money from something else you would otherwise wouldn't necessarily include. And so we think about the valuation, the investment opportunities, the growth opportunities, always worth being very careful and just to understand exactly where it makes its money rather than where you think it makes the money.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, mate, we've got to dip into the Motley Fool mailbag. This is one of our favourite segments, and judging by the correspondence we get, one of the favourite segments of our listeners too. As always, you can email us at info@fool.com.au or hit us up on Twitter. We're at @TheMotleyFoolAU. I'm at @TMFScottP. And Doc is at @AnirbanMahanti, AnirbanMahanti. AnirbanMahanti. You can get us, hit us up with a question. We love hearing, we love interacting with you. Again, even for those who aren't on Twitter, I get it, but seriously, give it a go. It's actually pretty cool. I don't own shares, by the way. You don't own shares on Twitter, do you?
I have some short puts.
Very good. So, a platform worth being part of. We can argue with Doc about this, worth investing in a different time. All right, so the first question, mate, we've got a couple we want to get through because we do love hearing from you, and while we're busy with earnings season, we do want to cover some of those questions as well. So, got a question from Giuseppe, who starts by saying, insert suitable praise for the awesomeness that is Scott and Doc. I appreciate that. That's very kind.
That's great. I love questions that start like that. It's awesome.
The other good thing is Giuseppe's obviously listening because he knows that we do laugh about the fact that to get a question on this podcast, you have to speak nicely of us and
We should up it and we should say they should share it with one person that they really love.
And send us some money.
And I'll share it with two people.
Send me some money.
You don't have to. Send it to three people. Come on.
All right. He says, yes, and of course I'm a paid-up member of a few services. Thank you, Giuseppe. With all this talk of mortgage brokers going around at the moment, do you think it will spread to other similar services, such as insurance brokers? Now, Giuseppe's question comes on the back of the Royal Commission. Mortgage brokers are in the gun. At the moment, it seems like if Labor does win the election, as they're favoured to do, it will be the end of mortgage broker commissions. And if that was the case, not going to be too many mortgage brokers around. And the question Seppi asks is, okay, let's assume that's going to happen. What about insurance brokers? What comes next for them? Have any views?
Again, I think independent advice is important there, right? Mm-hmm. But I think most of the insurance, I mean, you know, insurance is sold by your big banks and so on, mm-hmm. and you know, your accounting firms and things like that. I don't really have strong views on this. But I think insurance, again, Australians on average are underinsured mm-hmm. compared to other parts of the developed world.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say.
So... Maybe it's not that big a problem yet because, mm-hmm. you know, we have a strong appetite for investing in property and things like that, but maybe not a strong appetite yet for insurance products. So maybe it's not that big a deal.
I think we know insurance commissions are going away. That does put more pressure again on insurance brokers, like mortgage brokers, to find a way to basically justify their existence. And if they have to charge us fees rather than getting a kickback from the insurers, I say kickback, not actually in a nefarious way, just in a commission type way. It makes it hard, right? So yeah, look, I think, Giuseppe, to your question, I do think the brokerage world is undergoing a big shakeup, and I do agree completely with you, Doc. I've got to say, I really am quite torn on the mortgage broker and the insurance broker problem. We want people to get independent advice. We want them to want that, but we know that we've talked about this before. The behavioural realities of people actually putting their hand in their pocket. If you could spend two to save 10, would you do it? Well, you should. Are most people going to? Well, probably not. And again, does that mean you end up with worse outcomes, with worse insurance policies, no insurance, under insurance, as you say? I think it's a reasonable reality. Now, I don't know how we fix it, by the way. I don't know how we come up with a model that allows people to make sure they are appropriately insured, they have appropriate mortgage advice, they have appropriate understanding of the market, so they're getting the best deal without that conflict of who's paying the piper. So yeah, I'm torn, mate. I'm almost in favor of a halfway house where the government standardizes the payments so that you can only get, you get a kickback from the insurer, but the kickback is the same no matter which insurer you go with or which mortgage you take up. Mm. In other words, there is no incentive to recommend one product over another product, and there's no incentive to increase the amount of insurance in dollar terms. If you get $100 per insurance policy or $1,000 per mortgage, then there's no incentive there to push people into a different product or to get them borrow more or be more insured because you're getting a larger kickback. I think that's what I would do if I was given the choice. It does mean more regulation, but I think that's probably the least of all the evils.
No, you could still, you know, the company could say you sell more of my products, right?
But that's what you just limit it. But again, you're still incentivizing
people. You're still getting the same.
Particular company, right? So I would say no matter what product you sell, you get one-off fee from the insurer or the bank or the mortgage provider of X dollars.
Yeah.
And everyone gets the same amount of money, and there's no incentive for it. It doesn't matter what volume you do with what product, you're always incentivized to do the right thing, but you're taking that hurdle away from the consumer, so the consumer is going to want to get the best advice without feeling the pain of the hip pocket.
Well, then the insurance company is going to take the brokers out to Fiji for a nice party, or to Hawaii for a nice party.
The old soft commissions, exactly.
The soft commissions will kick in.
Well, we know that even in the medical profession that happens, right? There's been plenty of stories about that sort of stuff going on as well with, you know, incentives from drug companies, and it's a messy, messy, conflicted world. Let the buyer beware, and hopefully government does the right thing.
Modly Fool Money.
Mate, let's move on to another question. We had a question from a listener who's asking a couple of specific questions. So this listener asks about being in the US, but opening a brokerage account for a 16-year-old Australian son. So lots and lots of complex stuff there, right, in terms of how we treat tax and all that kind of stuff. So the couple of questions... he says, when it's time to transfer the account to my son, will I be able to just put it in his name and let him take control of it? I don't believe the company is in Australia because he's based in the US, so I'm not sure if this is possible. Now, there's a whole lot of tax implications here, and it's complicated by the fact that we think our correspondent Rod is a US citizen, a US taxpayer, and his son seems to be an Australian resident, Australian taxpayer. So there's a whole lot of complexity there. I've got to say, for what it's worth, again, we can't give independent tax advice. This is one, Rob, where you really do need to go and speak to someone. Thanks for listening, by the way. Rod also said some lovely things about us, but I've cut it short just for the purposes of trying to keep the podcast a bit shorter. But Rod does say all the lovely things, including that he listens to our podcast, and he's very happy he did. So from that perspective, I've got to say, yes, changing, there's nothing stopping your son from having a US-based brokerage account. But the complexities between going from a US taxpayer to an Australian taxpayer account feels to me like a really, really complicated area. So I'm going to duck the question entirely because I don't claim to have really strong cross-border tax knowledge. I know what it's like to be an Australian taxpayer with a US account. That's easy. But I don't know what tax or other implications the US government and or the Australian government would apply to that change of ownership, particularly because you're changing tax jurisdiction. So first thing I'd say is I'd get independent advice. The other thing I would say probably, Rod, is for what it's worth, he's 16 now. Once he's 16, that actually should, he's not a minor from a, or he won't be a minor soon from a tax perspective. It may be worth, depending on where you're opening it up, actually opening an account in his name with an international broker in the first place. And that's probably what I'd suggest. It shouldn't be too difficult to do, though it may be problematic. Frankly, if it comes to it, you may want to just simply invest in your name in the US. And then when he becomes 18, simply selling those shares, you may have to pay some capital gains tax, but it's probably worth doing that. Alternatively, and then investing, basically setting up a fund for him when he's 18. I think you can do that reasonably well. None of these are particularly wonderful options because international tax law, let alone local tax law, is incredibly difficult and complex. He does say, lastly, I was hoping you could recommend a couple of Australian stocks that are listed on US exchanges I could add to his portfolio. So Rod, in this case, again, is in the US, but he wants to invest in some Australian companies for his son. Obviously, his son wants to know those companies. Unfortunately, Rod, the bad news is that most of the businesses that are big enough to have a US secondary listing aren't necessarily companies we'd recommend. The big banks, for example, all have US listings. But again, I wouldn't necessarily go down that path. I'm not sure, Doc, if you know the answer to that, of which companies Australia have US listings.
I can name one. I don't know whether it is. ResMed is both a US listed company and an Australian listed company. I don't know whether it is primarily listed in the US and then they have CDIs here, or correct, is the other way around?
No, the primary listing is in the US.
Okay, so the primary listing is in the US. Maybe you could buy, I'm not sure. Things like CSL and so on might have. Mm. It's hard. Yeah. I know the banks have ADRs, but I wouldn't go for the banks.
Look, I think this, we're not giving you a very satisfactory answer, mate. We do want to cover it, even though we can't give you a wonderful answer, just to kind of let you and our members know the complexities of international tax law. I would be inclined to save for him for the next couple of years, open an account in his name. If you want to do something, a way to open it, for example, would be with Interactive Brokers, who have a completely global platform. It's a very difficult platform to use, but it might be one you want to go with. Another one, for example, is Charles Schwab, who has an office here. So there are ways of opening accounts with brokers. I know you're with TD Ameritrade in the US, and I know you'd rather keep with that broker. I think, frankly, for your son, I would put money away now for the next couple of years, and on his 18th birthday, open an account for him. We rarely say don't invest. In this case, I just think, for less than 2 years, because he's already 16, the trouble hassle you're creating, I honestly would save some cash. Basically, put the money aside, transfer it to him or transfer it to his name after his 18th birthday, and then invest accordingly, probably with Interactive Brokers, because then you can access it from anywhere. You can also set up directly in his name in the US, but you can still control the account potentially. So lots of different options. Unfortunately, none of those perfect.
Motley Fool Money.
All right, Doc, next question, and probably the last question for today. Hello, Fool Kings. I like that.
I love that.
Isn't that good?
That Fool is Kings. Awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Why does this last?
King and Ebon and King Scott. I like it. Do we reign together? Are we co-kings? Is that the idea?
I don't know. You can be the king.
I don't want to be the king.
You can be the king.
I have no aspirations of grandeur, mate. Trust me.
I don't really need to be the king. but I like the,
We like the
title. Thanks,
yeah,
I like the title.
All right. Yeah, that's right. Honorary kings.
Yeah.
So King Doc, Chris says, I absolutely love the podcast. Listen every Saturday as I walk. Thank you, Chris. We hope you're keeping safe from traffic. Living in Singapore. There we go. I am. Oh, mate, I've made this page too big so I can read it. I've lost the rest of the line. Here we go. Living in Singapore. I'm sharing with Aussie mates. There we go. In January, I became a Motley Fool Share Advisor member. My question is, how are dividends and franking credits applied when you are in an ETF? For example, the Australian VAS, the Vanguard Australian Shares. Well, it says VGA. I don't know if VGA is the code, but he talks about ETFs. And how do dividends and franking credits apply? How are they applied in that circumstance?
So I think they're just carried forward normally, right? The dividends are paid into the fund. The fund basically just forwards it through in their dividend, and basically they collate all the franking and basically passes it on.
Correct. That's exactly the story.
But I don't know whether the Singaporeans actually can benefit from the franking or not.
Yeah, that's right. So this is where it gets a bit complex, and you're exactly right, Doc. That was going to be my point, so I'm glad you picked it up. The dividends and franking are absolutely carried straight through to the taxpayer or the investor. You'll receive at the end of each year, you'll basically receive a franked dividend, and those frankings are basically the franking credits passed through from the ETF to you. So that's the positive sign. as Doc says, if you're a Singapore taxpayer or a Singapore resident for tax purposes, to be more specific, then you won't be able to get those franking credits. Now, I will say, as I say with all the stuff about franking credits, don't avoid an investment because you don't get the franking credits. Yes, they're great for Australian residents. They're wonderful. We love them. But please don't avoid an investment just because you don't get the credits. If it's a great investment, it's a great investment regardless. Just because it's slightly less great than it would be if you're in Australia doesn't invalidate the idea as an investment. If you believe that the Australian market, for example, is going to go up meaningfully in the next 5 or 10 years, then don't miss the forest for the trees here. Don't avoid an investment like that because of the franking credits. But yes, if you're a Singapore resident for tax purposes, unfortunately, the government's going to keep the franking credits. You'll still get the dividends, but the franking credits will go to waste. All right, Phil, thank you very much for listening to us. We hope you've enjoyed this first Earnings Palooza podcast. I have a feeling we may be doing another one next week. There'll be another week's worth of companies to report, and we'll bring you the highs and lows and hopefully something in between. And of course, as I said, we love your questions and comments. Please keep them coming. It gives us something to talk about and, frankly, lets us know that we're answering the things that you want us to talk about, which is the most important part of this. Doc and I do like the sound of our own voices, but we hope you're enjoying it as well. And don't forget, you can subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app, as I say every week. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a rating, leave us a review, tell your friends. It helps us become a little bit more better noticed. And while, yes, that's good for our business, we do this for free. We do it largely because we kind of love it. And we want people to get the investing bug, understand a little bit more about investing. And if the tone of our emails from our listeners is anything to go by, hopefully we're delivering on that goal at least a little bit. Don't forget, you can also get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox by going to fool.com.au/MMM.
Triple M.
Triple M. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.